Welcome to the Wedlake Bell Legal Podcast, covering a range of legal topics, including updates from our four practice groups: private client, real estate, business services, and dispute resolution.
Welcome to the Wedlake Bell Legal Podcast, Episode 2, Workplace Harassment, the Key Issues. So I'm Adam Grant, and today I'm joined by Blair Adams, who's a fellow partner within Wedlake Bell's employment team. So as listeners will be aware, the issue of harassment has never been higher on the public agenda, not only in respect of what happens in the workplace, but also regarding the attitude of society as a whole. There's been some truly shocking research published in recent months about the extent of harassment at work, particularly sexual harassment against women. So in some respects, the climate's becoming more supportive of employees who make these allegations of workplace harassment, and employers really need to adapt to this. So in this podcast, we're going to focus on two key aspects of workplace harassment, namely, one, what steps should an employer take to protect their workforce and themselves, and two, the use of non-disclosure or confidentiality agreements. So Blair, are we just talking about sexual harassment?
Well, no, harassment can relate to a number of other protected characteristics, to use a legal expression, and those are age, disability, gender reassignment, race, religion or belief, and sexual orientation. The common thread between all of these cases is that harassment is behaviour that violates an individual's dignity, or behaviour that creates an environment for them that's intimidating or hostile or degrading or humiliating or offensive. Those are the adjectives used in the legislation. So you get the sense that it's a very powerful combination of factors, and it can take the form of behaviour that's directed at an individual, or even behaviour that's just going on around them.
So Blair, from your experience, are employers always liable when one employee harasses another?
Yes, the default legal position is that they are liable, but there are two ways in which an employer can seek to avoid liability if harassment has occurred. The first is if the harassment did not take place during what's known as the course of employment, and there are a lot of cases about that, particularly involving harassment outside of the workplace, but nevertheless in a work context. The second is to argue and use a statutory defence that you took reasonable steps to prevent harassment occurring, and that's what we're going to focus on in this podcast.
Yeah, so that's interesting. The term reasonable steps can be quite wide, so could you put a bit of context on that?
Yeah, it's fairly well established that it involves a number of things. Firstly, it involves having an up-to-date policy that addresses workplace harassment in all of its forms. Secondly, it means training employees on what that policy means, so what constitutes harassment and why it's unacceptable. And finally, it means dealing with complaints in an effective way. Now, many employers do have equal opportunities and harassment policies, which is of course very positive, but I think these days in the changing cultural attitude towards harassment, that's not going to be enough. Courts and tribunals will expect you to take active steps to make sure that staff understand what the policy means and why it's important, and that's where training is relevant.
So that's a really great point, Blair. I mean, we all know how hard businesses try. It's really difficult to engage staff with these types of policies. It can be a real struggle to get them to basically properly read and understand what the policies aim to achieve. So for those listeners, do we have any tips on how they may engage staff?
Well, I think you've got to make the training relevant to the environment in which people work. You do see training courses in which people who work in fast-paced and flexible office environments are trained on what I would call factory floor type examples that are really not particularly relevant. It's also got to be aimed at the right issues, really. Harassment takes or occurs on a scale that ranges from very brutal examples, such as physical assaults, to potentially very subtle examples and power play and the rejection of, for example, females in senior positions, that kind of thing. And training courses need to reflect that, and they need to engage intelligently with staff in the right context. If they don't, not only will they be ineffective, but you're going to have a hard time convincing an employment tribunal that you really did take reasonable steps to prevent harassment occurring.
So from your knowledge of case law and legislation, have you got any views, or do the tribunals have any views on how this training should be delivered?
No, delivery method is your choice, what works best for you and your workforce. What really counts is the content. And then, of course, the follow-up, are you keeping a record of who's had the training? Because if you are involved in a tribunal dispute, you want to produce records showing that a particular individual did receive the training. So we'd say that it's a very good idea to have training as part of an induction for new joiners, because the reality is that the problems can occur from day one. And it's also very, very advisable to repeat it at regular intervals during employment, every 2, 3, or 4 years, for example, or actually to roll it out again if there has been a particular problem, you know, with either an individual or in a particular area, to reinforce the values you're trying to get across.
Yeah, so have you seen any instances or are aware of any instances where training has really helped an employer defending a tribunal claim?
Yes, absolutely. It, in two ways. Firstly, it allows you to include in your response to a tribunal claim the statutory defence under the Equality Act that you did take reasonable steps. And secondly, the tribunal will consider the evidence of that and could, if it's on your side, absolve you of legal liability as a result.
So, I mean, but these days, you know, lots of employers do go put in place policies, but is ticking boxes and having a policy in place sufficient?
No, I think you're right. We're seeing an evolution in the approach, and I think just making employees watch a 20-minute video and then ticking to say they've completed it may not be enough. I think employers will have to do more to reinforce a culture and values in which harassment is clearly not tolerated. And that, again, it's a circular thing. It means educating people to understand what harassment is so that they can spot it and act on it.
So could you expand upon what employers should be doing?
Yes, this goes to the third element we talked about earlier, which is reacting appropriately when there is a problem. And that often comes down to things as basic as taking it seriously, which sounds completely common sense and obvious, but sometimes does not happen because other factors such as a desire to perhaps shut down the problem and prevent, you know, knowledge of it spreading can take over. So HR professionals and senior management need to understand how to react to an accusation, how to protect the accuser, how to protect the accused to avoid stigmatizing and prejudgment. And another factor would be if the allegations against someone senior, which it often is, you mustn't be seen to be giving them special treatment. You've got to be as rigorous in investigating them as you would be with anybody else, otherwise you're giving a clear signal that different standards apply. Another point would be that if a complaint of harassment is upheld, you've got to deal with the guilty employee, if we can call them that, appropriately. And that might mean obvious sanctions like dismissal or warnings, but it can also mean perhaps more subtle and in fact effective responses. So one-to-one counselling is one that I've seen, re-education courses, you know, quite intensive courses about behaviour and harassment over a period of weeks, or even an internal move away from the person who's been the subject of the harassment. So tone from the top, to use that expression, is important, because in any allegation or investigation, the senior people need to lead by example, and they also need to set the standards for interpersonal behaviour and communication. But I think to be effective, organisations need to be a bit more open about harassment when it's occurred. This helps them learn the lessons, it helps educate other employees, it helps impose the standards that the whole training thing that we've talked about earlier are designed to introduce. And going to shutdown mode is generally unhelpful.
So are these issues any relevant if an employer receives a claim?
Not just then. I think claims do focus the mind. They put the spotlight on issues and on particular people. They involve a lot of time, they cost money to defend and investigate and potentially settle. I think you need to think about the general well-being of staff and also about culture and reputation, because if harassment occurs, then it can result in a business earning an unwanted reputation for its behaviour and its culture. And, you know, that can cause you to lose talent and find it more difficult to recruit and potentially even lose business.
Yeah, so in your view, do you think the government is going to take any steps to develop any legislation in this area?
Well, there's nothing concrete that's immediately in the pipeline. At the moment, though, there's quite a growing amount of pressure from organisations such as the Equality and Human Rights Commission and other pressure groups such as the Fawcett Society. And one of the measures they want to see introduced is a positive duty on employers to prevent harassment. Now, that doesn't exist at the moment, and it goes quite a lot further than the current state of the law. The EHRC also wanted to introduce a statutory code which would increase its powers to investigate complaints without the individual needing to submit a tribunal claim.
Great. So, I mean, this has been really helpful stuff, and obviously there's a lot to cover for employers. So if you could give listeners three takeaway points from what they should be doing, how would you summarise those?
I would say make sure your policies are relevant and comprehensive and up to date, of course. Think about training that's relevant and effective, not just a tick box. And make sure you, i.e. your HR team, your senior management, are ready to deal with problems.
So let's move on to the second part of this podcast, namely the use of non-disclosure agreements or confidentiality clauses in settlement agreements. So as we're aware, there's sort of been a lot of publicity in this area, and we've even seen solicitors being called to Parliament to give evidence. So we think this deserves perhaps a bit more analysis. So Blair, what do you think are the specific issues?
Well, to give a bit of background, Adam, the controversy began when it emerged that a woman who called Zelda Perkins, who'd worked for Harvey Weinstein, the film producer, been made to sign up to some extreme confidentiality terms as part of a settlement agreement. Now, that agreement was actually entered into almost 20 years ago, but when it came to light last year, it was generally seen as highly oppressive and unfair, and that contributed to the backlash, if you like, the shift in culture that the emergence of allegations against Harvey Weinstein and others was producing. And as a result, it's put the terms of confidentiality agreements under really intense scrutiny.
So could you give some examples of those extreme terms?
Yes. Zelda Perkins, the woman concerned, was not even allowed to keep a copy of the settlement agreement. Only her solicitors were allowed to hold one. And that demonstrates the extreme paranoia on the employer side, if you like, about the risk that any of the underlying circumstances would ever come out, or the terms of the settlement. She was also specifically prohibited from revealing any of the allegations she'd made against Weinstein, even in the context of seeking medical advice. And by all accounts, she was quite traumatised by what happened to her, which sounded extremely unpleasant and was almost brutal. And yet, she was supposed to not even tell a counsellor or a doctor about what had happened.
Wow, so those are quite draconian terms and things that you don't often see. So I can understand why that came under scrutiny. So have there been other sort of high-profile cases?
Well, I'm sure many listeners will have heard about the President's Club episode also last year, and that involved a similar approach to confidentiality because the women who were, shall we say, hosting the event or had been engaged to work as hostesses were made to sign very extreme confidentiality provisions before the event. In other words, it was almost anticipated that there would be inappropriate behaviour, and they were being gagged up front. And that led to a considerable public backlash against that sort of approach.
So we all know that employers do like to protect confidential information, but in light of these recent cases, what is the impact on so-called normal confidentiality provisions?
Yeah, what's normal is in itself, I think, now part of the debate, because there's definitely a shift away from the former approach, which was you won't tell anybody anything ever. But if we consider in detail two typical terms that we see in settlement agreements, and let's just talk about why they may no longer be appropriate or might need some adaptation. So the first would be a promise by the individual not to make any future disclosures about the circumstances that have led to the settlement agreement. So that could be the acts of harassment, a grievance about it, or even a tribunal claim. Now, a blanket ban of that nature is now potentially unattractive because it could be used to prevent the victim of the harassment discussing their experiences in a number of perfectly legitimate contexts, which could be seeking medical treatment, having therapy, just talking about their experience with friends and family, or even doing something that they're perfectly entitled to do, like making a report to the police. So I think the shift in culture that we've seen in the last 12 or 18 months or so makes complete bans like that feel entirely inappropriate, because they're just a way of silencing the victim and effectively handing power to the harasser. The second would be a warranty or a promise by the individual that they have not already told anyone about the harassment. And that's something you also commonly see in settlement agreements. Again, that's unattractive because the effect of making someone promise they've not revealed anything about what they say has happened is to isolate them. And it's seen as a way of silencing them and depriving them of help, and therefore is ethically very dubious.
Yeah, so are we saying that these clauses are unlawful, or just in a moral and social context, are they just unattractive and controversial?
I think potentially both. There are some doubts about their legal enforceability, because clauses like this could be void if what they're doing is preventing a victim of harassment making a protected disclosure, or, to use the common shorthand, whistleblowing. They'd also be void if you tried to use them to prevent a victim pursuing a criminal conviction or potentially even pursuing a civil claim for damages on the grounds of injury that she'd suffered, although that's the sort of claim that's often waived or partly waived in the settlement agreement itself. The other thing that people need to be aware of if they're using lawyers to help them resolve these agreements is that the regulatory body for solicitors in England and Wales, the SRA, has issued instructions to solicitors not to be involved in drawing up oppressive settlement agreement in cases of harassment. So there's now a professional obligation on lawyers not to be seen to be imposing these extreme confidentiality clauses.
Yeah, so if we look at all these developments as a whole, you know, what approach would we be recommending that employers should now be taking?
I think the key is to be proportionate and targeted and only look for the protection in an agreement that A, you really need, B, you can actually enforce, and C, is not oppressive. And I think for some people that will involve a shift in their perception of risk. It means you can no longer expect to impose black and white bans, if you like, and you have to be a bit more comfortable with there being some potentially loose ends in terms of future disclosures about what's happened. But I think that's ultimately more healthy both for the organisation and society as a whole.
Well, thanks very much, Blair. That's been really insightful. And thanks, listeners, for downloading this podcast.
You just listened to the Wedlake Bell Legal Podcast. If you liked our episode and want to know more, then check out our website, www.wedlakebell.com. Wedlake Bell. Building relationships is at the heart of everything we do.